Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Live special number 283, recorded Wednesday, April 20th, 2016. NAB 2016 Live, Day 3. This TWiT Live special is brought to you by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to learn more. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, and we're coming to you live from the show floor of NAB 2016 in Las Vegas, Nevada. If you want to know anything about broadcasting, about editing, about your workflow, this is the special you need to watch. So stay tabbed as we bring you all the greatness from the most broadcasted show on Earth. One of the pleasures of NAB is the ability to see how the big boys do it. What gear, what techniques do they use to get those shots, those beautiful shots that we love so much? Well, here at IndyCam, we get to see exactly how they do it because I'm speaking with Raphael, who's going to show you how the pros get those hard-to-reach shots. Raphael, what is this? I mean, it looks a little bit like a hobbyist camera, but this has been used by major motion picture studios to get those impossible shots.
Yeah, it's a tiny camera, so our thing is about making tiny cameras, but they're professional nevertheless. So this camera, for instance, is used by Ron Howard on In the Heart of the Sea, where we built very advanced underwater camera systems. They have all the professional controls that you expect from a film camera, like the big cameras they use. And they can use these cameras because they are so small or might be mistaken for a hobbyist camera. You can put them in places where you couldn't place a big camera because they're too big. So they're raw recording 2K cameras. These, they have been around for a couple of years, used on really huge, huge productions. And they run up to 60 frames a second and record in Cinema DNG RAW and deliver you great quality.
You know, what strikes me about this is we're used to seeing large cameras, like the ones that our cameraman is holding right now, to get the right shots, to get them with the frame rate that you want them, to get them with the color accuracy that you need. You don't expect to have the package this small. Normally, when it gets down to this size, you're thinking GoPro quality, which is good, but it's not great. What do you do? What is your special sauce that makes this format work for pros?
Well, for film production, it's definitely the RAW workflow that lets you inject it. You know, you can use the images in a regular DI post-production. Then we have a very special sensor. They're global shutter. They're not like GoPro's rolling shutter. They're global shutter. And we have an internal ISP, a signal processor that's really good. Thermal management, special lenses, and then system design, the entire thing, you know, to put all together, that it really works well in the hands of professional crews. That's what we do.
From little cameras to big sensors, let's go ahead and move on to this. This is the new kid on the block. This is a professional 4K VR 360 camera. Now, you've done a couple of interesting things with this. First of all, you're only using two sensors, two sides of this camera ball. We've seen devices that use 2, 3, 4, 6, and one even use 14 different cameras and stitch them together to get their image. What made you use two?
Well, first of all, the size, you see, it's very small. It's really, really small, and this has two advantages. First, you can use it like our cameras for film production. You can use it in spaces that are just very small and other bigger cameras you couldn't use. Second is that if you use a very small design with two sensors, you make stitching and creating the VR experience much easier for everybody because the distance of the lenses is so small that you hardly have any parallax, what we call that causes the problems in stitching.
Now, if they wanted to find out more about IndyCam, if they wanted to see how the pros are going to be using your 4K 360 cam or the smaller cameras, where should they go?
Well, they should go online to our website, www.indycam.com. There we have a big portfolio of projects that we had, also sample clips, and you can also stay updated on this camera.
Raphael, thank you very much for speaking with us, and thank you for sharing your technology. Folks, big, small, indie.
I am really excited to be here with Eileen Rivera. She's Senior Production Manager at YouTube Spaces, YouTube Space LA, and of course, one of the inaugural All About Android hosts. And we worked together at Tech TV, and you were at Revision 3, so traveling in lots of the same circles.
Yeah, I think, you know, what goes around comes around. And now I'm here. I'm back. This is crazy. With you.
I know.
We never worked together at TWIT.
We never worked together at the same time at TWIT. I know. We went out to dinner with Jason Howell last night, and we posted a picture, and someone said, like, oh, you got the band back together. And I thought, well, except for we were never in the same band. Like, I never saw you and Jason Howell in the same room together.
No.
I thought maybe you were the same person until last night.
My husband also says that, you know, I'm kind of like, ship in the night. My wife is real, everybody, and she does work for YouTube.
Your husband. Now, who's your husband again?
I told you, everything comes around, goes around.
Well, Tom Merritt is the husband of Eileen Rivera.
Yes.
That's correct.
Yes.
And now you are at YouTube, and you are at YouTube Spaces, and you guys had a big announcement yesterday. I want to get to that. But first, for people who don't really understand how YouTube Spaces work, can you talk a little bit about what it is?
I'd love to. You know, it's what I live and breathe every day. So YouTube Spaces is basically the physical embodiment of YouTube. We're the home. We want to be the home for our creators. It was built for creators. Everything is free. And it's crazy because everybody asks me, like, why is this free? And I said, well, you know what? I work for the company that builds Wi-Fi balloons and self-driving cars. Why not invest in our creators? And YouTube, you know, kind of a behemoth in its own, you know, on the, with its video platform. And we believe in our creators. And this is one way that we're doing that, which is giving them tools, giving them access to things in the production world or even just, you know, learning how to build your brand and so forth that they may not have access to normally. And we have many spaces around the globe now. When I first started, it was London and LA. I started literally the first week that the space opened in LA, and now we have Tokyo, and now we have New York and Berlin and Sao Paulo and Mumbai, and it's growing every day. It's amazing.
It is amazing. Like, I follow you on Instagram, and I love the places that you travel and, you know, go to these wonderful places, and it's like, oh, there are creators there.
There are. There are creators everywhere. And so our motto, our mission is to bring together the most creative people in the world. And we do that by having three pillars: learn, connect, and create. I'm create, but learn is our workshop. So we have an EDU lead that, you know, production workshops, how to build your brand, how to build your channel. And then we have our connect lead who runs our events. So we'll have screenings, we'll have, you know, fan engagement events for our top creators, and, you know, many thing in between. And she leads that, and then I lead Create, which is our, you know, our production and our all the creators that produce in our 41,000 square foot facility. That's like what I oversee. And LA is the largest; it's the flagship. And you know, I love my job. I love talking to the creators. I love to know what they're doing. And, you know, what I want to do is make sure they have what they need in order to make their, you know, video production dreams come true.
So what are the requirements? I'm assuming anyone can't just walk off the street and become a creator. So what do I have to have a certain amount of subscribers?
Actually, your grandma can be a creator. Anybody can be a creator with a YouTube channel. So we really do foster that anybody can come and use the space. Now, there's different ways to use the space. So there's, you know, you can come to our workshops, and then anybody is invited to most of our events. But to actually produce at the space, you have to have 10,000 subscribers to start with. And that's sort of just our transactional way of sort of managing the thousands of creators that might want to use the space. And then as you grow in subscribers, then you get more days, you get more access, and so forth and so forth. There's a long sort of, it's not too long, but you can just go to youtube.com/space and find sort of our, you know, what we're all about.
Right. So yeah, 10,000, that seems like it's a reachable goal. Like, it seems like if you put the work in it and you have content that's good, 10,000 doesn't seem like it would be that hard to get to.
Yeah, I don't personally have 10,000 subscribers on my YouTube channel.
Yet.
So, you know,
after this interview, anything could happen.
I haven't really promoted that, nor do I have content. So you don't need to look at me. You don't need to look for me. But Yeah, I think it's pretty, consistency is key. And authenticity, we talk about, is key. So, if you keep at it, I don't think that it's an unattainable goal. I mean, we have a lot of creators that were, when I first started, were at maybe like 800,000 that are now at like 2 million. You know, they've just grown and skyrocketed along with the platform itself. It's crazy, but it's, and also amazing. You know, that a lot of these creators have audiences that are bigger than some TV shows.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I hate to use the word disrupt because it's kind of a cliche at this point.
And especially all the time anyway. Why not?
But it's amazing because obviously YouTube is a huge company and inside another huge company, Google. But then there's this tiny space, this area that you work in that really is, I mean, disrupting the model of traditional entertainment. I mean, the bar to entry was so high. I mean, even if you wanted to make an album or make a show or anything like that. It was so you had to do so much. You had to know someone. I think of like Rebecca Black or just like you had to have a huge check from your parents to be able to do something. But what you're saying, what you're describing really isn't that. It's just drive, content, people, and then you do everything else.
Yeah. I mean, I think, the beauty of what we do and is that it is all free and that we're trying to find, and that's kind of why I'm here at NAB, is like looking at the new tools that we have here that our creators will potentially use, moving forward. How do they tell their story with a lot of these new tools, whether it be VR, whether it be, drones. I hate to say it. Some people are very anti-drones. HDR, there's lots of different tools here. That's kind of why I'm kind of, walking around NAB. Kind of lost my train of thought, but
the model,
essentially really... what we want to do is, offer our creators a chance to try something new, maybe they're used to shooting videos at their home in their bedroom, but have they thought about using a green screen? Have they thought about using a red camera? Do they want to learn, like come to the space and you can learn those, and handle some of those new tools that they may not never have access to.
Right. So can you talk a little bit about the announcement that YouTube made yesterday?
I think, I don't know that I can do as great of a job as some of our product folks and our live folks, but we basically announced live 360 streaming on the platform. And I'm really excited because I'm flying home tonight. Tomorrow at YouTube Space LA, we are going to have our first live 360 streaming show with an artist named Dawn. The Verge is producing it, and they'll be there in-house. It'll be on their channel streaming live. So it's the first time we're doing anything like that. We like to be a place of firsts, right? Mm-hmm. So this is one of them. This is really new territory for us, and it's exciting to try it out for the first time.
Yeah. Will there be an audience too there?
Yeah. We're going to let in the first 100 people who, I think they RSVP. I'm not quite sure how they're managing the audience, but there should be an audience inside. So
if you were first RSVP, you get to come. That's cool.
Yeah.
So have you seen any technology here, cameras or anything that you think creators would be useful for creators?
Well, there's lots of things here. I mean, I think, the big buzz right now seems to be VR and, how to use it, how to storytell, which is different. It's one thing with music, right? It's a concert. You just kind of listen. Maybe there's a story within a song or something. But, scripted is interesting. So in terms of gear, I really encourage like the creators to kind of check out all the different kinds of VR cameras that's out there. Because I think it's sort of the next generation of storytelling. And we'll see how it goes. All of it's new to me, I don't want to say that I'm an expert at all. We're going to be learning. We're going to be having courses on 360 and VR at YouTube Spaces as well. So I'm going to be learning and growing, going on the journey with all our creators.
Yeah. From what I've learned, it's very important for people in the business to separate 360 from VR.
That's true.
I think that, which you have been doing. Because I guess VR is not a real world.
There's augmented reality, whatever.
Yeah.
One genre I think is going to be really cool that I sort of saw recently in like a short clip is horror. Horror in VR, first of all, please tell me if I'm going to walk into a horror situation because I will probably scream and fall on the floor if that happens. Somebody scares me or whatever. But I think that actually is a genre that could do very well.
Yeah. So do you have a lot of people producing horror content in YouTube space?
For the last several years, we've had what is called our tentpole programming, and we've sort of always had like a Halloween set and scary, you know, or at least we've been sort of encouraging that sort of scary content. But you could do a musical with horror or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we have quite a bit of creators that have produced horror content, you know, over the last year. Zombies, big deal, zombies.
Yeah, true. So what about brands? Can they come in and say, oh, yeah, like I, you know, could Coke come in and say, like, I want to go to YouTube Spaces and I have a billion subscribers. Would they also be allowed in there for free?
I mean, brands are also YouTube creators. You know, they have a channel. Anybody with a channel is essentially a creator. You know, when most people think about YouTube creators, you think about our endemic creators, mm-hmm. those that are sort of born not necessarily attached to a brand or a media company. But yes, brands can come to the space. We have a specific brand partner program for them, which is separate from the YouTube Spaces, but as a program itself. But they often come to the space and learn about YouTube and then, you know, could have access to shoot at the space afterwards.
So when creators come in, do you, at this point, having done it for as long as you have, do you have an idea when people come in who is going to be successful and who isn't? Or is it just a surprise every time?
It's like guessing who's going to be a viral hit. That's really, you know, you see special, I don't want to say special creators. You see people with a lot of potential. You see ideas kind of born, but it's, you know, you never know. Like, that person may decide they may want to go into marketing or something. You never know where their journey is going to take them. But certainly, like, I think you can see those that have really good work ethic and just really it's those that kind of, that can galvanize their audience a lot of the times and who can speak to their audience clearly and authentically that, you know, that is going to be successful for a creator, at least that I've seen. But can I really recognize it off the bat? Not always. Sometimes they come back, I'm like, wow. You know, that maybe they used a space a year ago, and then they come back, and they're like, you know, grew three times. And like, what did you do in between? That's amazing, mm-hmm. you know? And we hope that we're part of that journey somehow. We're, you know, giving them access, gave them sort of an idea to create something that maybe they're taking off, you know, elsewhere, and then they come back.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, elsewhere and only on YouTube, but, you know, like wherever they need to go to travel to, you know, create their content. So, but yeah, I don't know that there's an exact science, you know. I think that, creators just have to believe in what, just like anybody, like any podcaster, just any kind of content creator, like you got to believe in your content. And that should, you know, make you rise to the top, hopefully, mm-hmm. and be consistent.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Eileen. It's so great to see you. And I love that you're doing this. This is, I mean, because you've just traveled in, both of us have traveled in this world of creating content that is always difficult for people to understand in the beginning. Like, what exactly is it that you do? But like, you know, you find an audience. And so it's interesting that you're doing this now because it just really shows how there's so many audiences out there. And if, like you said, have a real passion for your work and you're authentic, then you'll find your people.
That's right. Find your people. You can find them. They're there. They're waiting for you.
Thank you so much. Eileen Rivera is the Senior Production Manager at YouTube Spaces LA. If you are authentic and you have content that you want to create and you have 10,000 subscribers, go there. And if you don't, then you can learn how to get 10,000 subscribers there too. Thanks so much, Eileen.
Thank you.
Here in the Fraunhofer booth, I ran across this really interesting thing called the Omnicam 360. Here to tell us about it is Peter Kauf, Department Head of Visual Imaging Technologies at Fraunhofer Heinrich Hertz Institute. Tell us what we're looking at here.
Okay, so as I already mentioned, we have a 360 Omnicam for 360 video capturing. That is our new version, which that is for 3D. And in comparison to the regular one for 2D, this one uses a double of cameras, so that we have 20 HD cameras here, and for each mirror we have two cameras, so that we can switch two panoramas, one for the left eye and one for the right eye.
Mm-hmm. Now, the smaller one, which we will show in a moment here, has 10 cameras, 2D. It's been used for a couple of years on a variety of projects, including live concerts and so on. Has this one been used in any production so far?
No, it has been finalized last week. So it's really, really new, and it's brand new.
Boy, that's a lot of data coming off of 20 cameras, isn't it?
It is. And it's also a complicated progress to bring all these things together, because it's not only to make a separate panoramic view for the left and one for the right eye. You also have to take care of the that the stereo quality is good, that all the alignment between the left and the right way view is correct, and to have a good stereo quality, which is not annoying and not...
We don't want annoying stereo.
Sure. I mean comfortable stereo,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, exactly. And so really the application is, there are many, but really what you want to be able to do is steer around a 360-degree view of a concert or something or another, and to be able to look wherever you want. Yeah. Sort of like virtual reality.
It is, yeah. And, of course, it is also very interesting for all these VR goggles, which are on the market at the moment. Yeah. And especially in this area, there's a large need for 3D, not only 2D, because everybody wants to have 3D at the goggles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is very exciting, and I thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
There are a lot of innovations here at NAB 2016, but there's only one company that can put the power of light in the palm of your hand. I'm here with Mornay from LoomCube, who's going to explain why this is the next device for all you aspiring photographers and videographers. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Now, what is this ridiculously bright, ridiculously powerful lighting device?
This is called a LoomCube. It's a 1.5-inch cubed light that emits 1,500 lumens. You're able to control it via Bluetooth through your smartphones and actually control light remotely. So you can connect, we say 5, but actually up to 100 lights to your mobile smartphone device. And now you can literally put light where you've always wanted it.
All right. Now, before we get any further into this, I have to ask, if you walk the halls of NAB right now, you're going to see a lot of manufacturers who are doing LED lighting projects.
Absolutely.
They're really good. They're light. They use very little power compared to previous technologies. And you have the ability to mount them on top of cameras without becoming a burden. But all of those products tend to be big. They're arrays or multiple units that you can use as an array. At the very least, they're, you know, this size to get the amount of light. What made you go smaller?
Well, I got to be honest with you. I used to be the head of business development and sales for a company called Nick Software. And we wrote an awesome little app out there called Snapseed. Got 10 million users in our first 3 months. And through all that, I got to make connections with the mobile photography companies, so Apple, Google, etc. And I noticed that all these small sensored products, or which I trademarked casual capture devices, these casual capture devices had an innate problem across the board, and that was lighting.
Right.
I saw in low light performance the GoPro, the iPhone, the Android, the Sony. Just about every small sensor device out there was not performing well in low light. And it was actually over a inebriated discussion in Vegas that a very good friend of mine and I decided that we were just going to go ahead and tackle this. And, of course, we went the route of Kickstarter. And, boy, what a learning experience right there alone. We raised $250,000 in a month. Our goal was $56,000, and we achieved that in 68 hours. So we were like, okay, it's time to quit our jobs, and we've got a new company to work on. So we had some challenges throughout the year it took us to create the LoomCube, but we were, you know, highly rewarded when we won Best Product at CES, both as a first year as a an idea, and then the next year as a product. So it's been an incredible journey, and we're just really happy because we're all photographers first,
right,
and we got to really solve a problem that we see rampant across the board. You know, nobody wants to lug their big lights, their sandbags, their generators, their batteries, or whatever it may be, and sometimes I don't need a six-hour shoot.
Right.
You know, what's great about the LoomCubes is I have off-camera flash control capability, so I can put these cubes around my subject. And then look through the lens of my video camera, my regular DSLR, and I can then adjust the light to see what I'm getting, till I like it the way it is. So that light needs to be a little less, that one a little more, and then I'm able to then go ahead and control my entire shoot.
That is the perfect origin story, because for a generation that is growing up on GoPros and GoPro-like devices, the last thing they want to do is to have a lighting panel that's 10 times the size and 4 times the weight of the camera that they're using. Now, let's geek out a little bit, because this is not just an LED light. This is a waterproof housing.
Right.
This is, it's really designed to be a companion to something like a GoPro, but it's also light enough to carry on a quadcopter. So one of the amazing things is you've opened up an entirely new category of lighting products, products that can light places that you wouldn't get a typical light source into, or products that can go up into a quadcopter and give you a light source that 5 years ago would have cost you a $15,000 crane shot. Tell me, geek out on the specs with me.
All right, so 1,500 lumens, 6,000 Kelvin, daylight white balanced. We have a nice little Fresnel lens in there that most people don't know what that is. And we got the idea, of course, from lighthouses. But a Fresnel lens goes ahead and disperses the light a little bit so that we don't have any edges or any magenta or yellows.
None of that harsh light.
It's a dialable, soft light. And it's, you know, can be used professionally by photographers, videographers, but it can be used by consumers to take a selfie flash. It is honestly the world's most versatile light. It's waterproof to 100 feet, and you know, it's more durable than the GoPro and the drones that carry it.
Right.
You know, if the drone falls out of the sky or into the water or onto the concrete, this will be the only thing that still works.
And because it's controllable via Bluetooth, I can imagine you using multiples around your set and then being able to dial down this light and this light but not that light, all while sitting in front of the camera.
Absolutely. I mean, this is also huge for periscopers or live broadcasters that you're trying to, you know, broadcast from their phone, and there's no, at least not a viable light on any of these smartphones to do that. So we're now making them actually look a little more realistic in these live broadcasts. We didn't understand how many people needed light until we created the Loom Cube and the uses that our customers are showing us. I mean, we do a nice little program, and thanks to GoPro for teaching us.
Yeah.
We give away 6 Loom Cubes every week.
Wow.
2 to the best drone video submitted, 2 to the best video submitted, and 2 to the best photo submitted. And it really is, it's been great for marketing, but at the same time, it's taught us so much because we actually see how our users out there are being creative and unique with the ability to literally take a high-powered professional light and put it wherever they want.
And I think that is the measure of success in the startup culture that we live in right now. Not necessarily did you make the product that worked as advertised. It's did you make a product that worked as advertised and then was used by users in ways that you never imagined. And that this is the kind of product that does that.
Well, you know, I get a lot of people coming up to me and they say, first of all, what's it feel like to be an actual success off of Kickstarter? You know, you actually produced a product and you did well.
You delivered it. Oh, my goodness.
Right. And I said, well, I got to be honest with you. Being a CEO of a company like this, I sleep like a baby. You know, I wake up every 2 hours and cry myself back to sleep. But having said that, that's the life of a startup CEO. And along the way, you know, it's been a task of passion. To think about this product in the very beginning, everyone was like, well, what is it? And I go, okay, take a breath. It is a off-camera flash and video light for your smartphone, Android, and GoPro, and any other casual capture device on the planet. And I was like, that's not really a name for the product. And it was really cool. My mom said to me, and thanks, Mom. Hi, Mom. She said to me, you know, honey, maybe it's like Xerox. Nobody knew what to call a Xerox in the first time, and it became a verb, you know, like Photoshop. Did you Photoshop that? And, you know, I think I've created something that's the first of its kind, and hopefully in the future everyone will be asking, well, what kind of Loom Cube is that? And I think, you know, that's what we've kind of achieved here.
Now, we can't let you go without showing off the drone-mounted Loom Cubes, because this actually has me excited. Brian and I are both planning on doing an Alien X build with Loom Cubes underneath. Tell us a little bit about this, because the videos from these types of quadcopters are spectacular. They're just so interesting because you don't get that shot anywhere else. What is this?
All right, so obviously we know the company who makes this drone. but what we've done is we've designed drone mounts that allow us to mount these these lights to the drone, giving you 3,000 lumens of output. And they only weigh 4 ounces each. So it takes off less than a minute of flight time. But the video we're creating, or the content we're creating with these drones, is absolutely epic. And having, you know, made that a little bit viral, we've of course had every drone company contact us and want to send us a drone to go ahead and create mounts for them. But at the same time, we've had a lot of the government officials, search and rescue, police, really wanting to use this, explaining to us it's faster, it's more efficient to search the waters, to search a field, than, you know, getting 60, 70 people out there holding hands trying to walk across it. So it makes me feel better that this product's also doing a lot of good.
Yeah. And shining down 3,000 lumen from the sky at any point that you need it, that's pretty original.
Well, you know, the nice thing, as you said, shining those 3,000 lumens, you can actually see your drone from a mile away, which is sometimes a good thing if that video feed is not working that great and you need to come home.
Yeah. Morne, thank you so very much for sharing your technology with us. Now, if they wanted to find out more about the Loom Cube, or if, say, they wanted to go to Amazon and buy one for under $80, where could they go?
Well, of course, you can go to Amazon. Mm-hmm. You can go to loomcube.com, that's loomecube.com. And additionally, you can find us at B&H, Adorama, and distributed worldwide.
There are a lot of options if you want that smooth, steady shot that most people crave. But there is none that's better than a GlideCam. I'm speaking with David, the CEO of GlideCam, who's going to explain why their series of stabilizers is quite possibly the artistic side of videography. David, what is the GlideCam?
The GlideCam is a three-axis gimbaled unit that transports any camera from nothing to 10 pounds these days. It has a three-axis gimbal and a nice movable head system, all counterbalanced, but no electronics. It's a bulletproof unit that has been surviving for years and years as something that never fails, less than a 1% repair rate on every model we make. Starting from the little iGlide 2, which just came out this year, this little iGlide handles anything up to 3 pounds. And you can say, well, how does it handle something that doesn't weigh anything, like a little GoPro is 4 ounces? Because it actually comes with four steel weight plates that come with each model. So if you have a 4 ounce GoPro, there's really no mass to it. So it doesn't work so well when you're running around. But if you add a couple of little weight plates and make it about a pound, pound and a half, then you can fly with it. And this little guy, it's got the little, this is a new little Blackmagic Micro on here. But you can see you hold it. Gimbal moves here. The camera is very fluid. You can flip it upside down, do all different stuff.
Now, all the professionals out there, they know the GlideCam name because everything from this to the more expensive series really gives us those shots that we love. But there's going to be people in our audience who are saying, wait a minute, why would I want an unpowered system? Why would I want to have to learn how to use one of these weighted systems rather than just buying one with a bunch of brushless motors? What makes this the preferred format?
Well, you know, that's the reality is that those brushless motor units take a lot more work than we actually do. These are very quick to balance. Within just a few minutes, you can put the camera on, move it back and forth, adjust the weights, and balance it out. I mean, with the motor stuff, which we are actually finally getting into, there is software that you have to download. There's batteries that you have to keep charged up. There's motors that can get jittery if you don't behave, you know, in a gentle way. These units, you can take it and go extremely slow, or you can just spin it around and look at you in a whip pan. I can flip it upside down, and there's nothing is going to get upset. And basically, years after year, there's just nothing breaks. I mean, repair rate, like I say, is under 1% globally on all these. So they're affordable and bulletproof in that regard.
Let's go ahead and take a walk over here, because I do want to show them some of I can't remember, what was the name of this series, but it's incredibly popular.
HD series.
The what?
The GlideCam HD series, yeah.
Now, when you're using this, if you could just demonstrate a little bit, how do you control it? Because I've seen people being able to do like just little finger touches to snap the camera exactly where they want it. How much practice does that take?
I mean, you know, there's guys that do it all the time, like Devin Graham, who uses it all the time. But the guy that gets it, he can unpack it, and he can pretty much balance it out within an hour after looking at the manual and start to walk around and get great smooth shots. So this unit here, you would hold it here. This is how the unit would work. See, punch it around. Whoop, there you go. Time for an edit. But basically, if you were to get this now, you'd put your camera on it, move it front to back or side to side for horizontal, add weights on the bottom, make it shorter or longer until it has a slow drop time like this. because you don't want it to be too bottom heavy. If I had a lot of weight on the bottom and I went like that, it would jump all over the place. Because it doesn't, it floats around. And then you just touch it here, gently controlling the shot. It pretty much does it for you as you walk around. So
no fancy electronics. It's all physics. It's all basic physics.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and let's put that one down, because as fantastic as those are, people have been crying out for a powered glide cam, and that's what we've got over here. This, I understand, is a prototype. So this is going to be available. Not available yet. Doesn't even have a name. But show me some of the finer points.
This is supposed to start shipping, I would hope, in 90 to 100 days to dealers, but it could be a little longer. This is like the fourth one we've done in just a matter of 2 months. But this one is really refined. All these servos have slip rings in them, so there's no wires, as you can see. So it looks like it's wireless. Every unit can spin 360 degrees. So there's no tanglements. One of the reasons why we didn't get into it a while ago is it was so much jitteriness of motors, and also that there could be wires that are tangled and ripped off, and we just didn't want that problem. This unit here has an on button here, and then it has a button there that controls three different modes. There's modes that control how many motors are activated or not. But, you know, this is something I've hesitated to do for a long time because of the repair rates that are out there. I mean, 15, 20% is ridiculous. But we feel this unit is going to be right in there with the GlideCam stuff. Very, very low repair rates and high quality. So,
David, you were telling me that GlideCam it's a small company. You keep it small, you keep it lean. It's about 20 warriors who are cranking out everything, and it can actually be difficult to get some of your product because it is in such demand. If they wanted to find out more about maybe where they can get on a list, maybe where they could start taking a look at some GlideCam products of their own, where should they go?
Well, GlideCam.com obviously is a great place to go to find out about what's coming out new. But B&H in New York, for example, in the USA is the biggest dealer we have. They do take pre-orders on stuff. We expect to sell out of this, whatever we're going to make, within a few months for the year. So when B&H gets them, put it on the wish list or get on their pre-order. Get it on the pre-order. You can prepay.
David, thank you very much for talking to us.
Appreciate it.
And here at NAB, we don't film, we glide.
Hey, everyone. We're here at the TWIT stage at NAB and having a lot of fun, just seeing a lot of really cool technologies, kind of the technologies behind the technologies. That's a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. We've got Sean Seyfried, CMO of Pixvana, on the stage here. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sean.
Thanks for having me. It's
great
to be here.
I'm super stoked because I'm like all in on this whole VR thing, virtual awesome. Reality. It's exploding right now. It really seems like it's just grabbing the attention of people who are fans of technology and people who have no idea. It's been on the horizon for so long.
Yep,
and
exactly.
It really kind of seems like it's having its moment. Would you agree with that right now? Does it feel like there's a difference right now with VR?
Oh, absolutely. 2016 is definitely the first year of VR.
Mm-hmm.
It's really coming real. You know, people are just now getting Oculus headsets and Vive headsets where they can plug them into PCs and actually start experiencing good VR.
Yeah, it's a good foundation. So before we get into a little bit about what Pixvana is all about, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a founding member of Pixvana. But what's a little bit of your background?
So I have been doing software development for about 20 years. I've worked at a company called Puffin Designs way back in the 90s with one of my colleagues who's here, Scott Squires, and our CEO, Forrest Key. And we developed a commercial version of Scott's technology that did rotoscoping and painting.
Okay.
And it was used on a bunch of movie productions back in the 90s.
Tell me a couple, because I have a feeling I might know. Is there Waking Life? That was a rotoscope, a famous rotoscoping one.
That was a totally different technology.
Was
he actually built a custom tool to do that movie.
Okay.
It wasn't us. But we did a lot of films where you had to have dangerous shots, like on Gladiator.
Okay.
So they would use our tool to take out the tiger that was swiping at air,
right,
and kind of make it look like he was swiping at the Gladiator. So that was kind of our origin. And then for the last 13 years, I basically have been building visual effects tools and plugins for After Effects and all the video editors at Red Giant, and I'm one of the co-founders there. So, and that business is still going great, and still making cool tools, but I really got into the VR thing and wanted to go off and do something new.
I can understand that, especially once you kind of think of the potential, like the kind of looking, you know, forward of the potential of what VR could become. It really seems like you're at the ground level of something that's very exciting and has a lot of momentum right now. So
yeah,
that's
exactly.
A good change. Good,
yeah.
Good focus.
that's why we formed the company, because we really felt like this is going to be a new medium. It really is kind of like the dawn of television. It's sure. something that's going to be both the same and different. It allows you to consume media or have interactive experiences, but it could be both of those things at the same time.
Sure. And many things that we don't know yet. You know, right. It's still so early. We don't know where this is going to mature. So I guess start from the beginning as far as Pixvana is concerned. What are you aiming to solve specifically as a company in the world of VR?
Well, I think part of the foundational problem we wanted to solve was the artifacting and the lack of quality in some of the VR videos, specifically on mobile. In the Gear VR, you had a lot of softness, and that's mostly related to the streaming quality is pretty poor, and the field of view is really only looking at a small bit of the image at once. So there's a lot of naive approaches out there to streaming, and we really wanted to fix that problem because we're a bunch of video geeks have been doing this for 20 years, and we just looked at that, and it felt like a huge letdown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really feels like that is still kind of one of the downsides of any of the VR that I've played around with. It's better than it was, but it's still, you get a little bit of that kind of, the delivery, it's never quite as sharp. Part of that, of course, is the technology, you know, that the headset itself, what is the maximum resolution that it can produce?
Sure.
But it's never quite as real as I have a really good feeling eventually it's going to be.
Exactly.
And your delivery, I mean, this is content delivery, essentially, is what Pixvana is kind of focused on, right? Use it through the cloud.
Yeah, that's one of the technologies we're working on in the lab at the moment. So we look at this as kind of an end-to-end problem. You want to start with the largest possible master that you can. Mm-hmm. And we're focusing on two things. We're making bets in the cloud and making bets on VR video consumption.
Okay.
Because we think that many people are going to want kind of a lean-back experience where they're isolated in headsets and can fully immerse themselves in the content. But to do that, you really need to have great visuals. And you need to have a great story. Those are kind of the two elements of immersion. If you can have spatial immersion where you feel like you're there, and you can have story or narrative immersion where you feel like you're lost in the story, then you really can get immersed. And it's different than gaming where you have this interactive immersion where your body is participating and you feel like you're in the space. And that's great, and it can happen much faster. But the same thing can happen with books and movies because you get lost in the story.
Sure.
And we think, if the video quality is good enough and it's not getting in the way, then you're going to have a great experience and you're going to start to feel like, wow, I was just someplace else.
Yeah, kind of building a strong foundation underneath, and that kind of widens the potential just at the very starting point, the beginnings of whatever project anyone's trying to deliver.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So for us, the cloud piece, we basically took some technology that we had at Red Giant, and we've licensed that to Pixvana, and it's sort of a core framework piece for us that basically allows us to build a system that can process these VR masters and turning it into a easily consumable VR stream.
Okay.
So the technology is programmable. It'll be scalable on an Amazon or Azure or other kinds of cloud systems using GPUs. You'll be able to do color correction and other types of things directly in the cloud, process that out, and then we're building a video delivery and client system that allows us to consume video that always looks perfectly sharp in whatever headset you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you have a headset that is like a Gear and you have a certain resolution, a certain field of view, we're going to process the perfect version for that. And then if you have a higher end headset or something else that has a different field of view, like a Vive that has a little bit bigger field of view, we'll do a separate master for that, going all the way back to the original plates and processing it through and delivering it to you in a dynamic way. So what we're doing is somewhat similar to what Facebook has done with dynamic streaming.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of switches based on what you're looking at. But we think there's other content aware approaches as well, because a lot of times you have a VR setup where the camera is still and the lights above us aren't moving, the floor isn't moving. There's a lot of stuff that's not moving in the scene. It's just us.
Mm-hmm.
So you could do a lot of content compression around just focusing on the characters and the story as well. And that'll give you a stream that you could really feel like you're at 4, 8, or 10K of resolution. And then you could start to do other kinds of framing as well.
Right.
You could, if you have a really, really large resolution, You could do post-process or on-the-fly processing for punch-in or zoom. You know, you can get framing for close-ups, you know, based on the head position or head tracking. So there's a lot of interesting things you can do in VR, and that's just, we're right on the cusp of being able to do that. So part of the technology we're building is enabling those kinds of experiments.
Wow, that's interesting. Obviously, a lot of challenges in, I mean, cloud just in and of itself is a challenging environment. Yep. Then you take all of these complicated kind of scenarios and potentials just surrounding VR and just kind of the dynamic underpinnings of what VR is all about, and you mix that with the cloud. That just seems like a minefield of challenges. What are some of the biggest challenges that you've encountered kind of in kind of ramping up right now?
Well, I think the biggest one for us as a team, I think we all know image processing well. We're starting to get our feet grounded in the cloud stuff and building a dynamic cloud processing system. So I feel like the company is well on its way to doing that well. Doing the streaming and the dynamic playback, that's hard because to make sure that you don't get sick, you really have to do it fast. And a lot of that depends on how quickly you can sense when the head is turning, how fast the head is turning, get that information back to the cloud so that you can process the right stream to the client. So there's a lot of interaction there where you don't have full control over the environment. You know, the phone can start to slow down just because it's getting heated up.
Yeah, right.
Like you can be on a Wi-Fi network and suddenly it goes away, and so the network can totally drop. So there's a lot of challenges just in that piece that I feel like we're starting to work out ways that we might compensate, but it's a tough problem to get right.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe a little bit of that kind of that that evil latency that always seems to creep up when you're dealing with video on the internet and everything. I don't know, is that kind of what you're talking about here? Because I guess from what I'm understanding from what you're saying, in VR it's not necessarily as simple as here's a video stream and do whatever you want with it. There is that interactivity. There is that, you know, head tracking is a really good example of that. That's going to change the dynamics of the video that you are even sending to begin with. So what kind of latency are you talking about in that regard?
Well, you know, the time from when you move your head to when the display gets updated is what you call motion to photon.
Okay.
It's kind of the term of art that Samsung and Facebook have built.
Yeah.
And, you know, ideally you want that to be within one frame time, so less than 20 milliseconds. That's really, really hard on a network when a lot of times the latency is 50 or 100 milliseconds. So now you're, could be 3-5 frames behind, and if you're 5 frames behind, your body starts to figure that out really
quick.
Yeah,
that's detectable by the
really
brain,
detectable.
For sure.
So, but, you know, as the next-gen networks come along, a lot of this is going to get solved in kind of infrastructure changes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, AT&T is starting to talk about 5G, or Verizon talking about 5G, and, you know, for today's voice communication in cellular, 20 milliseconds is fine. But they're talking about bringing that down to 1 or 2 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could do 1 or 2 millisecond delay on voice, well, you can do 1 or 2 milliseconds on data as well. And that means that in a few years, we'll be able to do wirelessly what today requires a very high-speed connection wired.
And at that point, it's practically imperceptible by the brain at all, right?
A couple milliseconds is not
You're not going to even detect that.
Yeah, you're not going to have the update speed on the headset that's going to be fast enough to keep up with that.
Right, right, good point. Yesterday YouTube announced its live 360 streaming, which sounds pretty incredible, right? Just the thought of, you know, I think the example I read was you've got, you know, a major NBA basketball game. There's only so many front row seats that anyone could ever possibly buy. So instead, we'll put you in that seat in a live sense, but in VR, and it's just this crazy shared experience in this immersive environment. I imagine live is part of what you guys are you know, have on the roadmap. How difficult is that? That sounds like that is incredibly difficult to do.
It is. I think it's not so hard if you're willing to have some level of latency.
Right.
You know,
okay.
If you're willing to be behind the stream by a minute or two.
Yeah. Which probably doesn't matter that much.
It's okay. But a lot of the problem comes from just getting the data up to the networks. Like, you know, you have to have a Teradek or other devices that you bond together, and then hopefully you get the streams up, or you have to be, like, in this kind of scenario, you would need a 50 megabit connection to get a good VR stream up to the cloud, you get that out, process it, and then go back to the headset. That's a big challenge. You know, even if you have a supercomputer in the cloud doing all the processing, that's tough.
Yeah.
So, you know, for us, I think the first thing we want to tackle is less on the live side and more on the cinematic side, because we're all storytellers and think about that end of it a lot. And starting with a really high resolution, you know, cinematic master plate, where you're starting with 10 or 12K as a resolution, means that you can kind of future-proof yourself for other headsets that are going to come along down the line.
Right.
You know, today's headsets are, you know, they're basically 1440p displays that are either together or you have one for each eye. But those are going to go to 2K pretty quickly, probably within 18 months, and you might get to 4K not too soon after that per eye. Mm-hmm. So now the pixels, even if they're this close, are going to be really, really imperceptible, like impossible at 1200 dpi for you to see individual pixels on the screen. So that really is immersive, because your brain is completely full. There's no screen door effect.
Right.
You know, it looks absolutely pristine. So that I think is what kind of excites me, is that future potential. I think there's also potential in the way the headsets evolve so that you can have interactivity. So if you have a headset that had eye tracking, for example, now you could have a setup or interaction on the headset that feels completely natural. So if I'm looking at something, I could be teleported to that space. Mm-hmm. You know, just by moving and gazing at one point in the video stream, I might be able to switch to a new location or change the storyline. So there's a lot of potential in that, just by having something that is a completely unobtrusive interaction design, where you don't feel like you're having to have a gamepad or wands or other kind of crazy things. Like, you could just do it through looking, and that would be amazing, because now your brain is completely full. You just look somewhere and you're teleported there. It's like, wow.
Yeah, I'm definitely understanding kind of the challenge right now. Just, it feels like there's kind of an evolving platform war going on, where everybody wants to have the VR solution that everybody, you know, the masses are going to adopt. It's just not going to be that way. It sounds like Pixvana is really just about making sure that no matter what the content is, no matter what the user is using, it can identify exactly what your parameters are. You know, do you have the hand controllers? Are you just a goggle? Are you lower res, high res, whatever? And really kind of scale that video to be perfect for whatever platform you're using.
You got it. That's exactly what our goals are. Is we want to make multiple clients, software clients, that can read these streams and play them back on multiple devices, even devices that haven't come along yet. So, you know, in the future, if you end up with a set of devices that is as lightweight and as simple as putting on a pair of glasses or, you know, sunglasses, that's the ideal, because that means there's not as much commitment to the device itself. I think that's part of the challenge, and I think that's part of why people are somewhat turned off by it, because they feel like, wow, I'm putting this pound and a half thing on top of my head, and that's a commitment. Like,
yes,
now
yes.
You've had to drop into it, whereas, you know, taking out your phone and looking at it, that's easy. If it was as easy as putting on a pair of glasses, like, people do that all the time. It's a natural social thing to do, and you would feel like, oh, okay, I'm in VR or AR, whatever, and that would make the ability to go into a story or a place much, much more natural.
Fascinating. Now, you raised $6 million last December.
Right.
When, and I have to imagine you guys are kind of ramping up at this point, when does Pixvana kind of come to market? When can the solution be reaching
partners? Well, because we had a very good seed round, we were able to sort of give ourselves some runway, so that we have a pretty long time to experiment with some of these systems and challenges and start to solve those. But in the summer, you'll definitely see the first iteration of our cloud processing, the first iteration of our playback systems, likely on something like the Vive and the Gear, because we've been early adopters of both of those systems. So look for that in the summer, and then, you know, likely in 2017, you'll see us go to market, and we'll start to actually have real products and a business that will be based on those products.
Yeah, right.
Whereas today, a lot of what we're doing is really about building foundational architecture and the right technologies and solving some of these problems. And it's part of that is it's just such a dynamic space. Even here at the show, you know, people are announcing multi-stream coalescing, like the Teradek Sphere or the Aura camera. You know, there's multiples of these devices that are just haven't even shipped or are about to ship that will start to solve some of the live problems, start to solve some capture and stitching problems. So I think we're trying to be a little bit patient because the market is changing so, so quickly.
But yet, at the same time, there are so many new players kind of on the horizon. These are challenges that they are going to face. So the fact that you are there with a solution, working on it, it's perfect timing for everybody.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why we made this bet late last year to start building this stuff, because we know that it's going to come along in the next 2 years. It's going to explode. Yeah. Already this year, they're predicting probably 8 million headsets in the market for 2016.
Wow.
That's a pretty substantial market. It's a tiny, tiny fraction compared to mobile devices or PCs.
For sure.
But next year it doubles again. The year after that it probably doubles again. So, in short order, you're going to be, the market will be larger than the iPad market. Man.
That's what they're saying. They're like 10 years down the line, it's the VR is going to be what smartphones are now. I don't know about that, because VR, at least in its current iteration, has kind of a certain scenario in which you would use it versus a smartphone being an everywhere kind of device. But who knows? Like you said, when we get to a point to where it's a matter of just putting on a pair of glasses you already have, and that contains the things that you're doing here, that's a different scenario entirely. Then, yes, everybody does have it.
Yeah,
why wouldn't you?
You can imagine. I mean, people have already talked about it and described these devices where, it's basically just like a pair of sunglasses. You put it on, it may have a small wire, and it goes to a mobile phone.
Yes.
So in 2 or 3 years, you could have something as simple as, like a pair of headphones. You just put it on there. All the processing is on the mobile device, but the display is built here.
And it's just the display.
Natural. And it's just the display. Everything sort of depends on the battery and the processing and the network on your mobile device, but the display gives you the ability to have that immersion or teleportation so that you could go someplace. You could be part of this crowd where you're watching us live, or you could go to a family event or go see something that, a place that you want to visit maybe next year if you want to go on vacation. So there's a million scenarios you can imagine if those streams were out there that you could easily consume and you had a device that was easy to put on and take off.
Right, right. Sean, really appreciate you stopping by the Twit booth to kind of just talk a little bit about Pixvana. I'm super excited about this stuff. I'm sure people can probably tell that already. Obviously, you guys are, and it sounds like you're doing a great job tackling some of these big issues. So,
absolutely, and we're among the vendors at the VR Village, so if you're here at NAB, go by the Village.
We'll be right back with more coverage from NAB 2016 from Las Vegas, Nevada. But first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this Twit Live special, and it's Epson. Now, you know that Epson has been a favorite of the Twit TV network for a really long time. It's what Leo trusts. It's what I trust. And now, well, they've upped their game with a revolutionary new EcoTank. Now, the new EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use those ink cartridges. It features an innovative refillable ink tank. Now, it comes with enough ink to print up to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. It's equivalent to about 50 ink cartridge sets, and that's in the box. That means that you're loaded and ready to print for up to 2 years before you even think about replacing your ink cartridges. Now, it's powered by Epson's leading-edge precision core technology, which delivers high-speed, vivid colors, and laser-quality black text. Plus, you get auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. Oh, it's no wonder that the ET4550 printer was named a CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. Now, all EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value with ultra-low-cost replacement ink bottles. Now, you have the freedom to print without running out of ink. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to get a little piece of printing nirvana. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers. That's Epson, EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson for their support of this Twit Live special.
I'm talking with Howard Luck, Director of Engineering and Standards at SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. And Howard, there are a couple of new things going on in the standards world here, aren't there? Particularly with regard to HDR, high dynamic range.
Yeah, absolutely. So HDR has become fairly popular with the content creation community and with the display manufacturers as well, recognizing that 4K may not be enough to make a big transition. So, of course, HDR along with 4K really makes a compelling content on the screen. Yeah.
But, of course, you need standards in order to convey that in a reliable manner.
Absolutely, especially if you want the equipment to talk to each other and actually if you want your content to show up the right way on the screen at the end device. So SMPTE's been working on a couple of standards, 2084, which is codifies the PQ system or the Dolby Vision system, if you will. There's static metadata that goes along with that. And then there's also work now going on with dynamic metadata that supports other types of HDR systems to the end device. Mm-hmm. So.
And whereas the static metadata, SMPTE 2086, right, is static, that is, it's right, one piece of information for the entire program.
Right.
2096 is going to be dynamic, scene by scene, right, and allow more creative control.
Right, absolutely. So it can be scene by scene or, you know, sequence by sequence, if you will, however you want to use it, but allows a lot more dynamic control over the content. You know, when you use HDR and it goes on different screens, there may be a different reaction depending upon the levels. Is it a dark scene? Is it a bright scene? You know, these things kind of tend to affect different display devices differently. So if you know that and you know that on the mastering side, then you can put that into the system and really get a compelling content on the other side.
Now, another really important theme here at NAB is the transition in the broadcast community or the content creation community from SDI, serial digital interface, to get signals from one device to another, to IP.
Right.
So what is SMPTE doing with that?
SMPTE's heavily evolved in the middle of that. We've already got a couple of standards that have already been done for transition of video over IP. And now with a new push from an Ames industry group, we've got a mass, critical mass now to kind of come to a consensus over a standardized way to put video over IP for studio video. Now, this is different than what you send through the internet down to your home, like Netflix, for example.
Well, it's different in application, but fundamentally it's similar.
Right, fundamentally it's similar, but the thing of it is that's heavily compressed type of thing. So in the production world, you need a lot more bandwidth and you'll need a lot more attention to synchronization and timing of these things to actually make that work for the studio production environment. So we're working on the next standard, which will be the 2110 standard, which is really comes from VSF and AMWA that comes into the SMPTE arena to be standardized, which is what they call the TRO4 system that came out of VSF. So we're doing a lot of work in that because we see the world is all transitioning over to IP now at the moment. So, of course, we've got to make sure that we have the same fundamental requirements, same capabilities that we used to have with SDI.
Right. Yeah. Exciting times.
Yes, absolutely. Good time to be in standards.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
If you've watched our coverage from CES or NAB the last 2 years, you know that in the drone world, there is one player above all else, and that's DJI, which is why I'm so happy to speak with Adam Najberg. He is the Global Director of Communications from DJI. Adam, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Padre.
Now, anyone who has read or flown anything resembling a drone knows the name DJI. You have built up a global brand, and you really dominate the market. What do you attribute that to? I mean, it's not just that you make products that are easy to fly. It's not just that you make products that are really high quality. You've garnered sort of a mind share of the drone space.
No pressure on us
at all.
So I think in the early days, you'd have to say it was because we were first movers, but that doesn't keep you in first place, and neither does being easy to fly or having good technology. I think we put a lot of stuff together. It starts with having 1,500 research and development staff. DJI is an IP center, and you know, for a China-based company, this has been almost unheard of in the last 30 years. This is no longer an outlier to me, though. I think that this is a really great example of how you lead a market. And then the other things we put in there, we're constantly innovating, but innovation without the ability to have a brand or market that brand is really important. Of course, your products have to hit the shelves and work when people take them out. And then it comes back to that same thing that you said at the beginning, which is ease of use. I mean, really underneath everything is we don't want something to be too complicated for you. We want to take something that was DIY and make it mass market and make it really easy for consumers to fly. And
I really appreciated with DJI is how quickly they expanded. Because when you got into the game, drones were around. They were mostly home-built. They were interesting oddities. Maybe you could get a shot or two, but it was typically with a low-quality camera. And then the field exploded, stayed on top of it. You increased your distribution, you increased your research. And now, whenever I think of the latest and the greatest in drone technology, it's probably coming out of DJI. Let me ask you about one of the more recent developments, and that is this idea of geofencing. DJI really started developing the technology last year. It's come to a head this year. Do you see that as a way to protect this hobby, this industry that we like so much? Because I think without technologies like geofencing, there becomes a mass hysteria about, oh my gosh, drones are falling out of the sky.
No, you're right. We pioneered geofencing in June 2013. We came out with the first version of geofencing. It was fairly brute force, very binary, either fly, no fly. And that's what was available. And for us, the important issue was we want to always balance. You know, when you sell a computer, when you sell a consumer product, you want to make sure that you're not hobbling it or handicapping it in such a way that it can't be used or enjoyed. But, you know, at the same time, you want to recognize that people need to learn the etiquette. They need to learn the safety. And this is a very good way to balance that. We did find from December of last year, we launched what we call Geo. And Geo is, everything in technology moves so fast. So this is an updated version that has live a feed of temporary flight restrictions. It also allows you to, if you have a registered account, to self-authorize and unlock certain areas for a short period of time. What this comes down to is we fundamentally believe that if you're flying something, you should be accountable for what you're doing. You need to know the rules, you need to be safe, and therefore the brute force isn't necessary.
Let me talk a little bit about that, because I firmly believe that DJI is committed to pilot safety and to pilots flying responsibly. In fact, DJI does offer sessions, flying sessions, for people who want to get into it. But there is a danger to being number one. And the number one is that almost every crash, almost every irresponsible pilot that you're going to see on YouTube is going to be flying a DJI because it is so accessible, because it is so available. Has that been difficult to combat? I mean, I don't think a DJI Phantom or an Insight is a dangerous quadcopter, but I think sometimes people who fly them shouldn't yet be flying them.
So, you know, as you say, when you're the market leader, with that comes great responsibility, and we acknowledge that. And I think that the most important thing for us is, you know, because probably 7 out of 10 quadcopters in the sky are DJI copters, that, you know, what this requires is a balanced and measured approach. What you don't want is regulation to be made hastily out of fear, out of concern, because of one thing that happened. I mean, just to point out, there have been tens of millions of safe flight hours. When manned aircraft started to fly, and, you know, think about how many fatalities happen all the time. What's happening right now, this is a very compressed timeline. These are much smaller craft. They are very easy to fly. You take your hands off the controls, they stay right where they are. I'm not downplaying any of the safety risks or concerns, but I think this is about education. I think this is about teaching people to be responsible. I think it's making sure that you have the instructions on the box, on the web, everything available for people, and the new pilot experiences as well. I mean, we are surrounding people with a rich collection of information on how you can do this responsibly. Probably the same way that car dealers do when a new technology comes out in their car. But that's really where our responsibility has to be.
We've addressed corporate responsibility. Now let's talk a little bit about what you've got. Because the DJI booth is one of the destinations, must-go destinations for NAB. What do you have that's new for the show, and what are you most proud of in your lineup right now?
Well, surprisingly, we came out with the Phantom 4. You had one on the desk a little bit earlier. We came out with the Phantom 4 in March. But that is a really big talking point at the booth. I think for a lot of people here, they haven't seen it yet. We launched it March 1st, and it was in the Apple stores, and then it just recently started to be available at other dealers. So for many people, they're catching the first glimpse. The things about the Phantom 4 that are so cool, we've raised the bar right now for consumer drones on the market. It's the only drone out there right now that has obstacle avoidance capabilities. It has some basic machine learning going on inside. There are five cameras slaved to one central processor. And what that does is it lets the Phantom 4 make smart decisions. So it's able to see something in front of it and say, there's an obstacle. Should I go over around it or should I just hover? But it makes it a lot safer to use. You can fly with more confidence, harder to crash. And I think people think that is very cool. It also looks like a high-performance drone.
Yes, it does.
It's, our other drones, are the Phantom 3s, you know, they're cute. And it's really, if you're flying your first drone, it's very nice to not have something that looks menacing. But this looks, this is the Ferrari of drones as well. It's very sleek. It's shiny. It also can fly in its sport mode at 45 miles per hour. That's something that, you know, people who have a lot of experience at the stick, that's the mode that they're going to want to tootle around in.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about the lineup, because DJI does have a very interesting collection of products. You've got the Phantoms, which, you know, they're sort of, they're not beginner craft, but they're for the people who just want to get into it. Maybe they want some decent photography, some decent videography, along with some fun flying. Then you get to the Insight, which is definitely a camera platform. It's beautiful. I'm sorry, the Inspire, I keep calling it.
That's okay.
The Inspire, which is a beautiful platform with a beautiful camera. And, you know, I wouldn't choose that to go sports flying. I would choose that to make a great tracking shot. And then you've got the definite pro versions of your octocopter. Is this lineup going to continue, or do you see the lines coming down at some point, maybe combining the Phantom and the Inspire?
Well, I hadn't really thought about that. You want to come over and work in my product for us? I'd say that, you know, the Phantom is showing that it can be both a high-end consumer drone and in one model and an entry-level consumer drone. I think with the Inspire, you're seeing sort of a crossover where you're getting the, you know, the folks who are really good at flying, they're going to be willing to pay the $3,000 or so, $2,500 for an Inspire. And they want that kind of performance. But it's also something that increasingly, you know, a couple of NFL teams have come by and talked to us. They use our equipment. We keep hearing other usage cases of in verticals. We first responders, firefighters using Inspire. So it definitely has that professional niche. But it's a crossover niche. You're getting photographers and aerial videographers who want to use those. As you mentioned, the heavy lifters, the hexacopters and the octocopters. We just launched the M600. Right. Integrated flight controller, and I'm mentioning this only because, not because it's a product plug, but because this is something that makes it easier if you're a filmmaker to get it in the air very quickly. You don't have a lot to assemble. Everything's pre-calibrated. So I think what's happening is the market is segmenting us more than we're segmenting the market.
Got it.
Right, so people who want to take a few photos in the air and maybe some fun family vacation video, you choose a Phantom. If you are more of a prosumer and you actually want to get some really high-quality shots, that's when you choose the Inspire. And if you're going to be hanging a RED camera off the bottom of your quadcopter, you get the heavy lifter.
Right, although I should add one thing. Claudio Miranda, the cinematographer on Life of Pi, for example, he spoke at a DJI event this past weekend, and you know he said he went out of his way to try to not like the Inspire 1 RAW. You know, it was a very interesting moment to hear him talking about it because I think he could take it up in the sky and make anything look good, but showed us a little bit of a clip. It was really interesting. His point was he had a $20,000 helicopter that couldn't take off because of some inclement weather, but he had his Inspire 1 RAW there, and he said, oh, why not? I'll give it a try. He put it in the air, and the image quality that came back, he said, just captivated him. You know, it slightly changed his workflow in post-production, but he just said he was convinced that this is definitely a tool in the arsenal when you're a filmmaker.
And I think that's the measure of success here at NAB, when you present a product that affects so many of the vendors here, because it's not just a quadcopter. It's a camera platform. It's a crane. It's a jig. It's a lighting platform. It's a scouter. So really, kudos. Very well done.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Adam Najberg. He is the Global Director of Communications at DJI. Now, if they wanted to find more about DJI, more about any of the products that you offer, where can they go?
This is the part where I get to talk about our website.
This is the plug, yes.
Whoops, sorry, I didn't mean to hit the microphone. Store.dji.com has everything you want from DJI.
I'm talking with Rich Welsh, CEO of Sundog, and also the curator and head of the Future of Cinema Conference here at NAB. And one of the really important things that happened at that conference over the weekend was a preview, a 10 or 11 minute clip of Ang Lee's new movie, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. Tell us why that was so special.
Well, this is the first time an audience has got to see the format that Ang Lee shot this movie in, or is shooting this movie in. And as you say, it wasn't quite finished, so there's some work to be done on it. But the format that we was both shot and displayed in was 120 frames per second, 4K, 3D. So that's 120 per eye. And it was also screened at high brightness. This is the first time an audience has seen any content like this in a cinema environment, shot natively like that and screened to them natively.
And as most people noticed and said, it didn't look like cinema that we're used to at 24 frames per second, which we're so used to for the last 100 years. This is really a new paradigm.
Yeah, it absolutely is a different experience. You know, the things that we love about 24 frames per second are actually its failings, you know, the motion judder. They're things that are limitations of the technology and the format. This 120 frame footage is like nothing you've seen. Like nothing you've seen. The 3D is so smooth. In fact, we talked to the audience about the 3D afterwards, and there was a 100% agreement that even people who don't like 3D liked it at this form, in this format. But it's more than just that technical improvement. This was creating an emotional bond to the content and a deep physiological reaction to it as well. It was a particularly frightening sequence from a war movie, and it really shook the audience.
It certainly shook me, and I know many other people. Ang Lee, in his keynote, talked about how shooting at that high frame rate actually increases the emotional involvement or the emotional impact of the footage on the audience.
Yeah, and that comes as many different functions of the format. One of them is just that we're presented with something where we don't really see any of these failings of motion rendition in the image. But there's another factor, which is that it's so clear and crisp. You can see the actors acting. You know, the actors have to be totally convincing, because it's like me talking to you now. I can see everything happening in your eyes. I can read whether you're lying to me or not, and you know, I know you're not. But my connection to you now, you know, which is a very real one, you get that in the picture on the screen. It's incredible, and it changes how filmmakers have to think about how they work.
I mean, it's amazing. He said that we had to relearn how to make movies. We don't know anything. We're having to learn it again as we go along.
He said it reminded him of, he feels like a child, and it reminds him of when he started making movies and he knew nothing. And he said, I know nothing about this. I don't know how to do this. I'm learning now. And we all need to learn. His whole crew needs to learn how to do this. It is genuinely a step change in the experience. I believe in this, actually. I think this is the future of cinema. It genuinely is. But it's going to take a lot of work, you know, not only in learning how to use that format and the things that we have to change, like lighting, makeup, props, you know, backgrounds, everything that we work on that we know about film has to kind of go out the window and start again. But also, you know, theatres to play it. That's a major limitation. We don't have anywhere that can really display this unless we build it from scratch at the moment.
Well, I hope more people get to see what I saw in the whole movie, which is going to be just incredible.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. I mean, we were very privileged to get something very early on this, but it's clear there's going to be you know, it's going to be yet more impressive experience when the movie's finally done.
When's it expected to come out?
It comes out on Veterans Day. Of course. So, yeah, it's later this year in the autumn and, the fall. So we're really looking forward to that. It's going to be we had a historic moment in cinema this weekend, and the release of that movie, I think, is going to be a watershed moment in the experience.
Well, like you, I can't wait. Thanks so much.
No worries. Thank you.
All right, here at the TWIT stage at NAB 2016, and I've got this guy sitting next to me that, you know, he kind of is just doing some amazing stuff. Your company, New Tech, is just doing some amazing stuff that we rely on at TWIT. Philip Nelson from New Tech. How's it going, Phil?
It is awesome to be here at the legendary TWIT webcast from NAB.
We are having a great time. Obviously, this the stage that we have set up here is phenomenal. We're running the show, you know, on a NewTek 8000. We've got that over there. RTD Brian is eating salad while switching our shows. That's how easy it is with the TriCaster.
You know, I actually tweeted a picture out. I took a picture of him eating the salad. He's got the fork in his mouth, and I tweeted, TriCaster is so easy to use. You can stream Twit TV live from NAB and still eat his salad. So I mean, comedy
like,
gold.
That's like the epitome of what I've always, you know, loved about the TriCaster. Of course, I started using the TriCaster years ago with, I think it was the studio, maybe even a bit earlier than that.
You guys have been a TriCaster family member since the beginning, really.
Yep.
Leo was an early adopter.
Absolutely. We had to do some really tricky things to do things like have lower thirds synchronized with video. We had to like take two buttons at
the
same time.
There were dirty tricks.
There were tricks. We made it work, but thankfully, you know, and obviously, which is just kind of proven by the fact that NewTek is just doing so phenomenally in this space, things got easier. Things got improved. Every time you guys come out with a new piece of hardware, it just takes that level of quality and that ease of use and elevates it even more.
Well, you know, that's what's made TriCaster so good is we have great customers.
Yeah.
Very smart customers, and every time we release a new version of TriCaster, we're taking all of that feedback and adding it in. It's funny, I can almost name features that certain people have suggested over the years that we've deployed, and you know that's why we have such loyal customers is because you know no product's perfect, but if it's good and you have a suggestion and it continues to get better and solves more of your needs and solves your problems, we win. And so it's actually been a pretty crazy few years for NewTek. I mean, we are, you know, our clients now are doing 250,000 hours of video a month. I mean, that's a lot of video. I mean, TriCaster really, you know, we're in 80 of the Fortune 100 companies now.
Wow.
You know, the NBA, NFL, Miss Universe, MTV, Twit. Mm. I mean, you guys are doing how many hours of video a week? 40?
Somewhere around there, 50, 60?
60 hours a week.
Yeah.
Eventually, you're going to do 26 hours of content a day. You know, you're going to pass the time of the day.
Well, because we've now actually we have two studios, so we do actually
you
do
could
some
do 48
content
hours
in Studio
a day.
B with another TriCaster.
No, but that's what's great. Yeah. You know, it's easy to produce. I mean, relatively easy. I mean, but you guys, y'all made web TV look like TV.
Yeah.
And that's why I think Twit is so popular, because you deliver a television experience no matter where your fan is. Mm-hmm. And we're honored that TriCaster is the technology that helps you guys do it.
Well, it's been a lot of fun from my perspective, having the chance to kind of learn the TriCaster over the years, all the new features. I feel like there's always so many features kind of embedded in there that I'm only scratching the surface based on what our use case is. But that's really the strength of what you guys do, right? You make this all-in-one production environment, and some people are going to touch a fraction of the features because that's all they need. And some people are going to push it to the limits, and things practically going to be, you know, smoke, you know, blowing fire. It's you know, running so much.
You know, that's we designed the workflow to be a scalable workflow.
Yeah.
You know, I can teach someone to run the TriCaster in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they're going to be ready to come in and produce your show, but they can switch cameras. They can add in some graphics, and then as your skills grow and your demand for better production value grows, there's all these layers in TriCaster that you can you can dig into and make your show look more and more like network television. So it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, very cool stuff. So kind of along those lines, let's talk a little bit about NDI. It's a network device interface. You guys announced it last September.
Yes.
And, you know, basically what I understand, open protocol for IP production. So basically this is meant to kind of coexist with just video hardware and audio hardware so that they kind of talk the same language as the TriCaster. You guys, I've been seeing a lot of, I mean, even here just at NAB, many announcements of new partners kind of with the protocol.
There are over 200 third-party developers creating NDI-based, you know, products.
Wow.
But what NDI, you know, IP video is the future. You know, we've been using SDI for many, many years and running, you know, if we have eight cameras, we have eight camera cables, and we have, you know, cable length limitations depending on, you know, various factors. And so in the IP world, it really takes a lot of that headache away with configuration. You know, here at NAB, there's a lot of discussion of IP video and what is your IP strategy. But the challenge is there are three different standards. You know, NDI is the new tech standard. It's an open standard we created, but we make it available for anyone to implement at no charge. Even if it's a competitor, they can add NDI. We want people to use it. There's also Aspen, which is a 10 gigabit IP protocol. Mm-hmm. You also have SMPTE 2022, which is a 10 gigabit IP protocol. And then NDI from NewTek is a 1 gigabit. So one of the things we try to do is create an IP standard that could work over a existing IT infrastructure, because not everybody has 10 gigabit.
Sure.
Okay, that's the first thing. So then the other thing we've done is we've partnered with Evertz, and we are now part of the Aspen standard. We announced that we now will support Aspen. Evertz announced that they're going to support NDI. So what's happening here is all these IP standards are now coming together, and it's going to benefit the consumer, because now you don't have to worry. You buy the device that you need or that fits your needs, and then we're going to help everybody talk.
If everybody's on this, NAB is kind of like the prime example of that, right? Like, there are so many, you know, hundreds, thousands of, you know, businesses here showing off their particular products. But if there's no way for them to kind of talk to each other, it really just raises the complexity.
Yes.
And that happens super fast when you're talking about, you know, production equipment in a studio environment.
A piece of software that we released to help solve that interconnectivity problem is called NewTek Connect Pro. Mm-hmm. And basically, it gives you four channels of conversion in a way. So I could take Aspen in, out to NDI. I could take NDI in and out to Aspen. So or you could send it out to certain capture cards from AGAA or Teradek devices. And, you know, so it's actually a really cool translator. You could even grab video clips and load them into NewTek Connect Pro and send those out as NDI or Aspen.
Okay.
So, you know, we're trying to almost be the Rosetta Stone for the IP world with our technology.
Sure. And explain a little bit about how NDI is actually passing through back and forth to the TriCaster. Is this just happening through a data connection?
Basically, if you have an IP camera, you can link it into NewTek Connect Pro and convert it to NDI. But if you have a device that supports NDI, you simply plug it into your switch.
Okay.
And it shows up. When you go into your configurations in the TriCaster...
That is so cool.
Instead of it being hard locked, like input one is SDI input one, input two is SDI input two, you just say, what do I want input one to be? And I hit load. And I look, and it just shows me thumbnails of every source on my network. Mm-hmm. Do I want the screen capture of your app, your Surface Pro? Do I want to take a VizRT graphics system? Do I want to take, you know, whatever? And you just say, I want that to be input one. It's so simple to set up. A funny story, when I installed NDI on my demo system at NewTek, I do a lot of interviews via Skype and from my office, so I have my office rigged up with lights and cameras. So I installed the Advanced Edition on my TriCaster. I had a camera feeding in, and I get an email from our trade show manager, and he's texting me pictures of myself. So what had happened is when you load it, it defaults to being a public source, and you can create work groups so that you can hide cameras from certain groups or just
probably
organize things.
Yeah.
But it was funny. He was like he was setting up the demo machines for NAB. He sees me, and so he starts taking pictures of the screen, you know.
Route your video.
You know, but it's really cool. And I mean, but it's that easy to set up.
That's
what makes NDI so powerful is it really is easy to set up. It just works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, LiveU, I saw a couple of days ago, adopted the NDI as well. What is that specifically enabling in this case? Obviously, LiveU is another one of the folks that even brought us to this stage. This is,
right.
Big reason that we are even here.
You know,
what is that NDI?
Well, any NDI support just means if you have a LiveU system and it's on the same network as the TriCaster,
it's an input.
It is a live source into your live production.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't get much simpler than that. And it saves a lot of headaches of configuration and specking out, you know, signal path, because all you're doing is plugging everything into a hub or router or switch and saying, I want to look at that.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about data throughput? Because this is going over IP. certain network infrastructures are maxed out as far as
through a single gigabit Ethernet connection, you can get 4 high def streams.
Fantastic.
One of the other cool things about NDI, though, you have a TriCaster 8000 here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you also had a TriCaster Mini. If I had 4 cameras plugged into that Mini and we're on the same network, I could assign those to your 8000, and now it turns from an 8 live camera switcher into a 12. It really is unbelievable. I mean,
that's great.
And that's why, we're seeing a lot of people that had TriCaster 8000s also add, I want a Mini, or I want a TriCaster 410 to add 4 more SDI inputs to my 8000, and now you got a 12 channel switcher. It's scary good.
That is crazy. Okay, so you were talking just a little bit ago kind of about Skype,
yes,
which is kind of a great kind of transition into another new product that I believe you announced here at NAB, TalkShow VS 4000. What is this all about?
Well, before I tell you about the VS 4000, it's really exciting to be here at TWIT talking about Skype, because you guys built the Skypeosaurus.
It's true.
You guys were pioneers of these large Skype chats.
Yeah.
And it's real-time, multi-person Skype chats.
Especially when you consider the 4-input aspect of the TalkShow VS 4000, the original Skypeosaurus. If you remember in the old cottage days at the TWIT Cottage, was a stat. Basically a grid of 4 monitors. I mean, it's basically, you virtualized the Skypeosaurus.
So, we know that talk shows and video and news stations all want to bring in remote guests.
Mm-hmm.
And there are over 300 million users of Skype in the world. So that's a nice pool to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also some problems with the consumer version of Skype. There's pop-up ads. There's incoming calls while your guests are on.
Sure.
There's all these little things. So we teamed up with Microsoft and developed TalkShow to have a professional broadcast quality interface for Skype that blocks out the incoming ads, blocks incoming calls, adds tally support, adds things like compressor and limiter to your audio.
Nice.
Adds color correction to a Skype call. And so, when we announced it, we released the first talk show a year ago, and it was just one user per box. So here at NAB with the 4000 model, you can now bring 4 guests in at a time from a single rack unit system and integrate those into your live show.
Mm-hmm. That is really crazy. Was this possible before Skype TX4? I know that that's kind of integrated.
No, this is, we worked with Microsoft and we developed this multi-channel in a single system.
That is crazy.
Solution, and it's available here at NAB.
Yeah, okay, so as far as availability, when can the public get their hands on it? How much does this cost?
The new talk show, the 4-channel talk show, retails for $79.95,
mm-hmm.
and it is available very, very soon. I would say get your order in today.
There we go. Okay, so you can pre-order now, essentially. Cool. What have we missed? What else are you guys doing?
You
guys have your hands in so many things right now.
So back to NDI.
Okay.
There is an announcement that is insanely huge, but also small. Sometimes those little small announcements are the game changers.
Sure.
We teamed up with Adobe.
Uh-huh.
You can buy a plugin called NDI for Adobe Creative Cloud. So if you're editing with Premiere, or if you're using After Effects, you can install this plugin, and you could be at your desk with someone editing in another room and say, hey, I want to see that edit you're working on. You launch your free NDI monitor, select their workstation, and you can watch them do a live playout without any rendering. You can also take that same playout and play it directly into the TriCaster live without ever rendering. So instead of rendering out a clip and putting it on a thumb drive or transferring it through the network, it is live playback through your local area network into TriCaster or to a remote desktop.
And that's
a $99 plugin.
That's awesome. That's a utilization of NDI that isn't quite as obvious,
no,
right?
But that's what NDI is going to do.
Yeah.
We're going to see all of these technologies that have nothing to do with live production, that just want to get video and audio from one place to another through a LAN.
Yep.
So we're super excited because we're making it very easy for people to get their hands on the SDK. It's free. So this Creative Cloud is going to be huge, because if you're doing a comp in After Effects and, mm-hmm. Maybe somebody
that
has to approve
yes.
it. I want you to, hey, Philip, I need you to take a look at this. What do you think? I don't have to leave the comfort of my desk. I just say, okay, hold on just a sec. Okay, play it.
And it's love true, it. High
Why
def.
Don't you move
yep.
that? I don't like the color.
Yep.
Okay, I'll call you again in a minute. Or you can just Skype them. So, but, you know, it'd be weird. This is actually like a game-changing, or not to be cliche, but a paradigm shift in our industry. Mm-hmm. Because we've been using, you know, standard video cables forever. And we're here at this beginning of IP video, and, you know, NewTek is making it very easy and affordable and low drama.
It's certainly come a long way from from the studio days where you had the VGA.
IVGA. But, yeah, we've been doing IP video since those days.
You've been doing it for a really long time.
So
Absolutely. Really cool stuff, man. I love hearing everything that you guys are always up to, because I'm just a huge fan of everything NewTek and the TriCaster. I mean, I kind of built my career around it for many, many years, so I really appreciate everything that you guys are doing. Before we kind of wrap this up, I'm also a big fan of your music.
Oh, thank you.
And totally non-NewTek related. I'm very curious. PhilipNelsonMusic.com is your site. But what are you working on? I heard a while back that you were working on an album.
Yeah, I'm doing a new album. But what's cool is the guy that I'm talking to about producing it, he does Kenny Chesney. He does Sarah Evans, Colin Ray. His name's Kelly Schoenfeld. He's a Nashville guy. Mm-hmm. So he's been linking me up with writers. I've been writing with one of the guys that writes for Brooks and Dunn. And, you know, it's going to be huge.
That is really cool.
It'll be better than Cats.
Material I imagine you're working on right now.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on when people will be able to see the album?
I'm actually just finishing writing the music. I'm playing some big gigs. I've opened it up for a guy named Robert Earl Keen on July 4th. It's like a 10,000-person show.
Dude,
I did an opener for Lemmy Robeson of the Dixie Chicks a while back. And
nice.
I'm just having fun, man.
I love it.
It's a great hobby.
Yep.
You know?
It is a lot of fun.
And it impresses my kids.
Yes, I'm sure.
Well, I will give one last plug. If you have a Netflix account, go watch the movie Adventures of Pepper and Paula.
Okay.
It is a family film, and my music's licensed for the movie, I'm in it at the end, and they use my music in the credits. So you can throw tomatoes at your screen whenever I come on the screen. It'll be like a Rocky Horror experience.
Right on. I will check that out. My kids are probably perfect age, and I'm sure they would love it, and I would love to see you in a movie. That's crazy. Philip Nelson of NewTek. It's just always a pleasure to get to talk
to
you, man.
Dude, thanks for having me. Awesome
show. Thank you
so much
for coming to the stage, and thanks for all of your help over the years with the TriCaster and NewTek technology.
Twit.
That's right. All right, Philip Nelson making the Twit live stream always awesome with NewTek.
I'm here in the Christie booth talking with Jeevan Vivaganathan, Senior Director of Product Management, and we want to talk about projector mapping, which is another thing here in the Christie booth that's very interesting. Tell us about it.
So Christie's been in projection mapping for a long time, and the most typical way people will see it is big architectural things. So you see a lot of these building facades at nighttime done with projection. A newer sort of area that we're sort of showcasing here at NAB is that we have projection mapping for things like arenas, basketball, for hockey arenas. And in fact, what we're really trying to show is that we have all this amazing technology. We've got great projectors. We've got image processing. We have automatic calibration that can make these setups of systems easy. We're trying to show the audience that it's not only like professional sports teams that can handle this kind of projection mapping, but that you can bring this down to a college level, university level, or whatever. It's a more accessible technology, mainly with some smart software tools that we're developing.
So you don't need a super expensive projector to do this?
Well, you don't necessarily need a super expensive projector, but it depends a little bit on what your aims are. If you're going to light up an arena, that's a lot of space, and Christie makes some of the highest, brightest, you know, very cost-effective at the brightness, but still, nonetheless, large-scale projection. So if you're doing something very, very large, you have to have, for a great visual impact for an audience, you have to have the right amount of light. You can't under-light it, and then people will fall flat.
Yeah.
So that aside, though, it is still a reasonably affordable solution if you want to do a basketball in a, you know, university setting or whatever.
So what kind of demos are we seeing here? I noticed a kind of a hockey field over there.
Yeah, so what we have on that our demo setup here is we've got some of our projectors called Boxer, Christie Boxer projectors projecting down, five of them giving a total 4K resolution image on this sort of mock ice rink we made. And what's really cool, and hopefully you'll get to see this, is we have some other things showing like interactivity. We've got hockey pucks flying around. We've got a Zamboni that we light up. And it's doing all tracking on ice and then showing as well with some actual software stuff how a college sports team could use it to introduce their team, put their own graphics into a very simple system. We're really trying to focus on the solution and not just the individual products. The idea that bring projection mapping more to the masses, more accessible to everybody, so you don't have to spend a lot of time on the technology and worrying about all those details. Christy can help you with that. That you can sort of go out and try and create an experience fairly simply.
Well, it's very impressive, and thanks so much for sharing it with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for taking the time.
While I was in the Sony booth, I ran into Jody Eldred, a DP, director, filmmaker, crash test dummy.
Yes. That's probably my favorite title.
Yes, and you actually shot all of the high resolution and high dynamic range footage that we're showing here in the show.
Well, I shot the stuff with the F55 that is in 120 frames per second 4K RAW. Now, I know that's a mouthful, mm-hmm. but Sony has a new recorder for the F55, which has been kind of their premier cinema camera for, you know, a few years now, and this recorder will record 4K RAW, which is the way you want to go if you're going to be, you know, grading your footage for high dynamic range, which is what all the new TVs are going to be. But it shoots 120 frames per second in 4K RAW, which is no small thing. So it's a pretty powerful little machine we have on the back of there.
It's a lot of data it's ingesting.
Well, let me tell you how much data it is. Actually, I found this out today when we were, you know, I'm a crash test dummy. This had never been done before. So they're like, so what's going to be involved in editing? We don't know. You're going to find out. And I did. A lot of data. And I found out today that the 120 frames per second, it's 4.8 megabits a second. That's how much. Gigabits.
I was going to say 4.8 megabits?
Pretty much, yes. So 4.8 gigabits a second. Yeah. So it's an incredible amount of data. So you need fast drives, fast processors. But the results are truly amazing. You're getting that full 14.5 stops of dynamic range that you can put into that HDR space so it looks like you're looking out a window when you look at this stuff. It was a great experience.
Now, you had to shoot it and grade it in a hurry, didn't you?
We did, you know, as always is the case with NAB. It's like, okay, here it comes. In fact, when the F-55 came out, they had me come out a couple of days early, and they said, we need you to shoot some F-55 RAW for us. And I was like, I've never even seen the F-55, and I've never shot RAW in my life. Oh, you'll be perfect. And they said, oh, and by the way, we're showing it to the press tomorrow, so make sure it's good. So that's my life as a crash test dummy. I make all the mistakes so no one else has to go and repeat all of mine.
So you're not showing it at 120 frames per second here, are you?
Well, actually, it's slow motion. So it's 1/5 normal speed. So it's slowed down by 5 times. Yeah. And that's why the data rate is so huge. Normally, it's still pretty big files anyway, because 4K RAW is 960 megabits. So you multiply that times 5 and you get 4.8, you know, gigabits. Yeah. But, so what you're seeing is the actual 120 frame slow-mo. And I'm just happy as can be with it. It really, when you do these experimental things where you've never done it, nobody's ever done it before, there's that pucker factor, like, oh, man, what have I gotten into? But we got in there into color grading. We're looking at the footage back on their Premiere X300 HDR monitor, and it was just like, this is exciting.
And there were some difficult shots in there, a woman with some flaming wands that she was dancing with and so on in a dark environment. I mean, that's very hard to shoot.
It is, and we've got kids running in a poppy field with the sun right behind her. And, we wanted to know what are the capabilities, but what are the limitations of the system. And you're only going to find that by reaching the limitations. So that's what we did. So let's shoot stuff that's tough. I can take any camera and make it look good. Give me the right lighting situation. I mean, that's not a big deal. Let's see what it performs like in really, really difficult situations. So that's why we intentionally shot stuff that's not easy to do. And I'm really happy with it.
Did you bump up to the limitations of the system?
Oh, yeah, we did. There's shots that you won't see. But that's what it is when you're doing tests. Yeah. You know, you got to say, okay, this is great. How far can we go? Okay, that's as far as we can go. Yeah. So now we know. And I was very happy to be the guy to find that out.
Well, it looks spectacular, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome, and, you know, it's coming to an HDR TV near you.
There's been a phrase that's been uttered around the halls of NAB for the last few years, an interesting piece of technology called computational cameras that, well, we know the promise, but very few have delivered, which is why I'm very happy to speak with Jason Rosenthal from Lytro. Jason, the Lytro backstory is well known to our audience. You came out with a bang, and you showed the world that it's possible to refocus your frames, refocus your pictures in post. And at the time, it was almost a magical technology. In fact, I remember the very first time it was mentioned on our network, we had guests who thought that it could be a scam, because it's not, you can't possibly do this. What is a computational camera? What is Lytra?
So Lytra is based on something called light field imaging. And the way to think of the light field is that in a normal camera, in a regular camera, when you take a picture, it doesn't matter if it's still or video or film or digital, you're really only capturing two properties of the light. You get brightness and color. In a light field camera, you get not only brightness and color, but you get all the geometric information about how every ray of light is traveling through every point in the scene. And what that gives you is not only an image, but a full high-resolution 3D model of your entire scene.
So that's so difficult for some people to put their mind around, because when they think of camera, they think of, okay, I've got film or a sensor, and I've got a light source, and I've got a lens, and that lens will determine what is and is not in focus. So once I've taken the picture, that focal length is determined. I cannot change it. What you've done is you've essentially taken away that lens, and you said, I'm just taking all the information, and you can sort through it after we're done.
So it's a really good description. It's really all about capturing as much information as possible about your scene and your environment, and then doing what we call virtualizing the live action camera. And by that we mean, think about taking any camera creative decision that today is locked in and baked on set. So this could be your exposure, your frame rate, your shutter angle, your focus, your depth of field, and all of those things turn into a computational post-process. Because when you capture the light field, you're able to really reproject all that information in any way and in any format that you want. And so our hope for the technology is that we're really going to open up a whole broad set of new creative elements and really give filmmakers and showrunners a new creative palette from which to choose from.
Now, one of the things that I think has been a challenge for Lytra is the fact that your technology is so different from what we've had before that it doesn't fit in the categories of cameras that we think of. I mean, we think of more resolution, more sensitivity to bright and dark, and that's about it. When Lytra first came out, people were looking at like the resolution and saying, oh, that's a horrible camera, not realizing it's a different paradigm. How have you educated people to understanding how computational cameras are not just bigger sensors?
So the world has really changed in the last couple of years, and I think as we've seen a bunch of exciting new developments, things like virtual reality and augmented reality, people are realizing that capturing just a single 2D image, doesn't matter how good the resolution is, it just really isn't good enough for the kinds of new applications that people are getting excited about. And that's really where Lytra comes in. And so later today at NAB, we're going to be introducing the Lytra Cinema Camera. This is something that we announced just about a week ago. You mentioned resolution. Lytra Cinema is the highest resolution video sensor ever developed at 755 megapixels.
Okay.
That can capture it up to 300 frames per second.
Okay, even if you don't understand computational cameras, I think you understand that kind of megapixel sensors. Let's talk about this, because it is big news, and I have understood that there's a lot of buzz from filmmakers who realize this really changes how they can compose their shots, because it gives them a second chance. If I didn't like what I did with my depth of field, if I didn't like what I did with my focus, I can change it weeks, months later when I'm going through the film. How has that been received?
So I think it's actually about something much, much bigger even than that, which is that we're really opening up all these new creative avenues. So it's not just about changing or correcting something after the fact. It's about getting a shot that you could never get before. So imagine things like breakthrough lenses, where the lowest f number lens that exists today is an f1 or an f.95 in some cases, but those are very, very difficult to shoot. With light field technology, we're able to do things like an f0.3 depth of field.
Whoa.
So a lens that you couldn't physically build, and then we make control over that all computational and controllable after the fact. So imagine, and we'll show an example of this later today, imagine a shot where you have a pair of hands holding a baseball and you've got the hands and the ball in super tack sharp focus, but the rest of the subject is completely blurred out and shallow depth of field, and then you can animate into an all-in-focus image. Those are the kinds of things we can do. And it goes even farther when you get into areas like visual effects, where we have a capability that we call depth screen. And this is the ability to shoot green screen without a green screen.
Wow.
So, again, we're excited to be here at NAB, where we have some of the most creative people in the industry, and we really see our opportunity and our role is to give them a whole new level of creative expression that hasn't been possible with current technology.
I think that's the truly exciting part about all this, which is I don't think we know yet how this is going to be used. I mean, you've told me some of the features that you can give to a cinema man, to a cameraman, to a filmmaker, but this kind of technology and the ability to choose exactly what you want out of the frame, combined with higher resolution screens, combined with HDR technology, I'm expecting to see something fantastic. I'm expecting a filmmaker to make something with a Lytro that's just going to blow away my expectation of cinema. So what's next then? I mean, if you've changed cameras, if you've changed photography, if you've changed how we make film, where does Lytro go after this?
So I think, I mean, we really look at it as we're in the early innings of our journey. So I think that, you know, if you trace the history of imaging and photography, you can go all the way back to 1839 when photography was technically invented. And we've had lots of exciting, interesting, important evolutions with perhaps the most recent one being the switch from film to digital going back about 15 years. What we look at, what we're doing with light field technologies, it's really, it's almost like starting over again, where we're establishing a new foundation, a new way of collecting light and data, and we think that the opportunities are limitless. So our vision is that over time, that really if you look at any device that has a lens and a sensor, we hope to power that with light field technology.
We've been speaking with Jason Rosenthal from Lytro. Thank you so very much for speaking with us. If they wanted to find out more about Lytro, more about your camera technology, more about the new announcement here at NAB, where can they go?
So if you're here at NAB, come to room S222 at 4 o'clock, and we will be doing a live demonstration of the Lytro Cinema System. We'll be unveiling the camera for the first time, and we'll be premiering the first short film shot on Lytro Cinema directed by an Academy Award-winning director and cinematographer. If you can't be here with us today, head on over to Lytro.com and we'll show you what we've got.
Here in the JVC booth, I'm talking with Dave Walton, the Assistant Vice President here at JVC. And Dave, the big news, one of the pieces of big news here at NAB is IP, Internet Protocol, and how that is changing the shape of broadcasting.
Scott, IP is being used in a lot of places, and we see its expansion over the coming few years to be just incredible. We're building it into almost every one of our major cameras so that you can connect to the Internet in a variety of different ways, through LTE modems or Wi-Fi or a direct connection to the Internet, and you can send the signals out that way in high quality. In fact, the bit rate's up to 12 megabits per second, so it's very high quality. And at the same time, you can still use it as a conventional product, record HD to a memory card. But the advantage is, of course, you can now do productions with multiple cameras without wires. Even if your control panel or your switcher is in another city, doesn't matter. You can have one camera in one city, another camera in another. Do multiple camera shoots that way. It gives you a lot of flexibility. It really opens opportunities up for people that want to come up with new ways to distribute content.
And you don't even need remote trucks anymore.
Probably not. I don't think we're going to put them out of business immediately, but for a lot of productions, the trucks would just get in the way. If you wanted to cover a half a dozen marathons with one camera in each city, well, you don't need a truck in each city. You can never afford to do that, let alone a satellite truck. So you can go out there with a JVC camera in each city, have those cameras feed a switcher in your home base, and now you can do a show where you're covering it. In fact, you could do your interviews all over the convention center and go live from one interview to another.
Well, that sounds mighty appealing to me. I'm going to see how we can do that. Thank you so much.
You just have to figure out how to be in multiple places at one time.
there is that problem. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
At NAB, it's not just about hardware, it's about the content. And today's content, well, it has a viewer with a more discerning taste. You need to make sure that your colors are right. You need to make sure that your 3D is pure. You need to make sure that's engaging, which is why we're here with Mark Hemmaker. You're from Autodesk. Autodesk is synonymous with tools used for animation.
That's
for,
right.
For 3D. Not only that, it's also synonymous with tools used for 3D creation.
Sure.
For, say, what we do with 3D printing. But you're here to talk about the content side. Specifically
sure.
about the tools that you've created for creating immersive 3D worlds. Yes. Tell me a little bit about that. If I were to talk to some of my students in San Francisco and say, this is the tool you should start with, what would be the one you would introduce them to?
You know, it's hard to pick a tool. Maybe a better way to start would be that, you know, if they think of the commercials that they see, whether it's a Super Bowl commercial or a film or a game, there's a good chance that a piece of Autodesk software was used for that. And, you know, I think 3ds Max, for example, is a good starting place. A lot of people learn 3ds Max as a 3D application first, or Maya, if they're thinking about visual effects. Those are kind of the core products that are at the, you know, I hate to say higher end because they're very accessible, but I think those are kind of the core products to start with. But what's interesting about Autodesk is we have a very broad product line. And what we've tried to do is we're all about creating and making stuff at right. all these different levels. You know, I'm from the media and entertainment division, which means our customers are film studios, commercial post-production houses, you know, individual creators that are making 3D content. But across our company, a lot of that core technology is kind of spread through our different products.
I have to ask, because as sort of an outsider, I mean, I know what the tools are, but I don't really have the skill to do anything with them. When I'm looking at Autodesk, and I'm looking at 3ds Max, I'm looking at Maya, I'm looking at Flame, what's the difference? I mean, how would you yeah. determine which tool to use for which job?
Well, I think to give you the high level, so 3ds Max and Maya are both 3D applications. They have different areas of focus and different industries in which they're more widely adopted, but fundamentally they do a lot of the same things. They create models, they animate, they, you know, you render out final elements, whether it's for visual effects or a full animated piece, or even creating content that you're going to 3D print later. So if you're thinking about 3D creation and that kind of meticulous process of making something in a virtual space, that's a starting place is a 3D application. You have to create that somewhere. If you look at a tool like Flame, that's more, we call it finishing, which is it's not really a made-up term, but it's not a. You have to think about what that means, because finishing means it's the visual effects, it's the compositing, it's taking video and putting CG elements over it, it's adding the color grade, so it's finishing the whole thing. So, you know, I'd say 3ds Max and Maya are a little more specialized in terms of creating that, whereas Flame's more of a broader tool in terms of finishing, but they're both super creative. I come from an editing background, so Flame is great for me because I respect 3D, I love it. I don't have the patience to model and animate. Because it takes quite a bit of time and right. and dedication. In the same way, you know, those guys that are into use Max and Maya, they're digging in and creating this unbelievable stuff. Now, at the same time, we have this broad range of tools and products around it. So, for example, we have a game engine. So if you want to create right, something right. and then bring it in and create a game or a playable level, you can do that in our Stingray game engine.
Actually, yeah, I think Brian has some slides from the Stingray game engine. And
yeah.
it's an amazing environment, because once you've started creating the world, you could just as easily use this to push it over into VR if you were thinking about designing something for, say, the Oculus Rift or for the HTC Vive. And you know, this kind of technology, just even 10 years ago, 5 years ago, it just didn't exist. I mean, you'd have to sure. be a professional developer who knows how to use a specific game engine, something like the Unreal Engine, in order to make this work. You're taking these tools that are used more for artistic types and giving us a seamless transition into game development.
Absolutely. So, you know, in terms of making games, like if you're using Maya, for example, you can just send a scene right into the game engine and it's live
right.
and you can work with it. So we want to streamline and make that easier. But I actually think from a broader media and entertainment perspective, what's really cool about Stingray being part of our portfolio is, you know, not so much to take over the world with a game engine, but we're now taking that, which is, a game engine is fundamentally a real-time renderer,
right.
whether it's for 2D images on a screen or for a 3D VR experience. And now our teams are figuring out where they can deploy that. in all these kind of cool and exciting places. So we have architects that are starting to get excited about some tests we're doing of taking their model from, you know, Revit or Inventor, or and now you can walk through it, which is pretty cool. Or, you know, or a virtually our Flame Compositor, we're enabling increased interactivity when you're working with a heavy scene by using Stingray technology. So it really is pretty cool how it spreads everywhere.
And I think that's sort of the dream for content creators, the idea of using a model that you might have created for an architectural CAD design and then just bringing it over and being able to drop it into the 3D compositor and then being able to drop that into the game engine. That's what you want. You don't want to have to recreate the same object again and again and again. You want to take something that you spent a lot of time on, that you're very happy with, and then it becomes your 3D game, or it becomes a VR video, or it becomes the next bit of 2D animation.
Sure, and we've seen this in a couple of places. You know, at a business perspective, I mean, you look at what the big studios are doing. They want to create content and create these immersive worlds, right? So you don't just see the Avengers movie. There's a game. There's a comic series. You know, there's this kind of world building. But I think the better story, you know, for me as a creative person and for, you know, for a student getting into this industry, it's that you're not limited because you can't access things, not just financially, but because everything works together. And, and it's like getting the technology out of the way of being creative. And I think that's why, you know, what's great about the internet is it's let us communicate. And what I love is seeing the explosion of content that people create, that they're just doing it. And now they have a broadcast channel for it. And that didn't happen 10 years ago. You couldn't get your content out there. Not only was it harder to make, but it was harder to show off. And now all of that's happening. And we really take that to heart in how we create our tools and how they work together.
I want to move beyond the tools, and I want to get your expertise, because you live in this world. And I want to talk about successful 3D and successful animation, because it's no longer just okay to have 3D. I remember the very first time I saw, I'm not sure what tool it was created on, but it was called Alien Song, and it was an alien dancing to Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive. And that was one of the first viral videos. It spread across the internet. Everybody loved it. And we were blown away that someone could create something like this. Well, that won't cut it anymore. I mean, your 3D models have to be beautiful, and they have to be seamless. In fact, Brian, you've got some examples of tools, your tools being used to create these beautiful immersive worlds that you know are created element by element, and then the camera can be flown through that world. In your experience, what is the uncanny valley as far as 3D is concerned? So how real can you get before it's too real? Or how real do you have to get in order for people to accept it?
Yeah, I think part of it is the tool never creates the end result. Like, the tool is used to make the end result, right? But there's a certain level of creativity. I mean, you can take the best tool in the world and have bad results.
Yes.
Right? So, I don't know that there's a... I think, you know, there's a dedication to learn how to create work that the professionals do. I don't think that means you have to be a professional. The examples you're showing, we see people doing things that are unbelievable. They put out this content just on the internet because they wanted to figure out how to do 3D camera projection and take old photos and bring them to life, right? I think what we've reached is a point where we sometimes say people don't notice CG anymore. I think people will always notice bad CG.
Yes.
I think people will notice what good CG can do, which is bring a character to life. But I don't know. I mean, Uncanny Valley is certainly a problem in creating the realistic character. That's always difficult. And I think that technology, we haven't solved it. I don't think anyone's really solved a way to make a realistic character that doesn't trigger whatever in your mind makes people worry that that person looks sick. But we're working on that as well. You know, and Maya's used to create some of the most realistic characters in the world. The games with the cutscenes that come to life where characters are, you know, you're kind of living in a cutscene and then you move right into the game.
Right.
This is all being done in Maya. It's one of the things I think the entire industry is trying to figure out how to tackle.
Does it bother you at all, as you said, that we notice bad 3D almost immediately? It's subconsciously we say, that's okay, I didn't like that shot. That didn't look real. That looked completely fake. But if 3D is done right, professionally, dead on where it should be, people won't notice it at all. People won't remember it at all. Mm. Does that at times keep you awake, or is that what you want?
No, it's all part of storytelling. You know, a great example, so I come from an editing background. I always like the process of taking footage and putting it together. I spoke to a Maya artist, and I love what he said. He said he started out in editing, and it wasn't good enough because he wasn't happy just cutting shots together. He wanted to tell a story that he could create the world and place the camera in it and get the end result. You know, and for him, a hyper-realistic result that you don't notice is CG is great because he's excited that you bought into his story. So right. I think that's part of it. And I know that little cliche, oh, it's all about storytelling, but it really is. Like, that's why we want these immersive experiences. Like, I love VR. The headset's great, but it's not about wearing a dumb headset that makes me excited. It's the smile comes from the fact that I'm experiencing something that takes me out of the world I'm standing in.
Right, right.
So
we've been speaking with Mark Hammaker from Autodesk. Mark, we're going to make it even better for our audience because I know right sure. now we have a lot of students who are listening yes. to us. And they might be thinking, I don't have the skill to create something like a Futurama introduction. I don't have I don't have the imagination to create moving pictures of New York. But I think we know that people should know these tools. You should at least yeah. understand the technology that's being used to create the content that you love so much. And you actually have a pretty good offer for students to try your tools.
Sure, yeah. I mean, for us, it's all about students. Like, you know, we want people to be able to access our tools. We don't make money off of students, right? And we actually make all of our software available for free to students. So I think, you know, just anything you'd want, whether it's 3ds Max or Maya, I mean, you can start at Autodesk.com. You can go to students.autodesk.com. We make it really easy. Sign up with your student email, and you can access all of our software for free. We have plenty of training content and other things. It's kind of the best-kept secret. Like, we don't want it to be a secret, or the worst-kept secret. I don't know what it is, but I don't want it to be a secret. We want all of the students to use our software and create amazing stuff, and then show us what you made with it, because we're always blown away with what people can make.
Exactly.
So,
if you're listening to us right now, I'll make you this promise. Both Brian Burnett and I will be doing some animation episodes on KnowHow in the near future, as soon as we figure out what we're doing. We're going to do a very poor job, but we want to see what you can come up with. We want to see your worlds. We want to see your objects. We want to see what your imagination brings forth. So if you want to do that, again, where do they go?
Just go to students.autodesk.com. It's probably the perfect URL to get you where you need to be.
Here at the Harman booth at NAB, I'm talking with Peter Chaykin, Director of Recording Solutions, about a new pair of headphones from AKG. These are looking pretty cool.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate your time. This is the K872. It's a new flagship headphone developed by AKG for those who create and monitor professional content. It's designed to have very, very neutral response. It's a closed-back phone, which means that it gives you the kind of isolation that you need in a pro application. But the extraordinary thing about the headphone is the drivers and the performance of these phones. They have a frequency response of 5 hertz to about 54 kilohertz.
That should be enough.
I can't hear out much beyond 30K, you know. Don't know about you.
Yeah.
And, you know, 18 hertz is about as low as I can hear.
Yeah, right.
But the amazing thing is that they're very, very comfortable, too. Typically, for a phone to be as durable as these are, and these are designed for professional applications.
Take a lot of abuse.
They take a lot of abuse, but typically a phone will be very heavy and uncomfortable. These are designed for comfort. From the ear pads, which are slow retention ear pads that kind of conform to your ear, but without perspiration. Again, it's a closed back headphone, so it's sealing everything out, but they have to be comfortable. This is a mesh headband that's adjustable. The hinge on this is something called a cardan hinge. It's precision, very precise hinge, and the cable is removable, and it uses a very, very nice Limo connector. Not an inexpensive part. So really no cost was spared. The driver is a 53-millimeter driver. That's a very large transducer. And it's has a 1.5 Tesla magnet.
Good God, there are MRI machines that are 1.5 Tesla.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And, the proof is in listening to these. They're just very neutral. They have huge dynamic range. They're very detailed in their frequency response, extraordinary low frequency, light, comfortable, durable. And again, this is I don't want to say it's a statement headphone because it's a very practical tool for people who create content. But this is the new, very best of AKG.
Okay, so how much?
They're $1,500 a pair. not cheap, but if you want the best and you want to be able to hear in a broad range of environments, seal out the outside world and not leak into open mics, do critical listening, whether you're mastering or monitoring content, you can't do any better than this. They come with a carrying case, beautiful carrying case.
Well, AKG certainly has been in the broadcast arena for many, many years, and this just seems to be the culmination of all that work, and I can't wait to hear them. When are they be available?
Be available in June.
Coming right up. Can't wait.
Hope you get to have a chance to hear them soon. Of course, you can listen to these here at the show.
I will. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
We've seen a little bit of everything here at the Live View booth at NAB 2016. We've seen some of the greatest in 360 cameras. We've seen some switchers that are to die for. And yes, we have seen the absolute best in 4K and even 8K content production technology. And of course, we've seen my friend here who has the absolute best in live streaming technology. Folks, this isn't just a special, it's a survival guide. If you are in content creation, if you are a broadcaster, if you at all love the process of creating, of imagining and bringing it to the screen, then, well, this was the place to be. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, saying goodbye from NAB 2016, Day 3.